Hello, welcome to a special edition of Spotlight on Travel. We're calling this episode of Spotlight on Something, and I'm with John Costa, and we've not been in, we've not done one for a couple of weeks because we've both been away and on our travels, and that's going to be the topic of our conversation today. I should just say I'm Rob Watson, and we are in the basement gallery at Adult Education on Beaver Street. John, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I was going to say I'm Rob Watson, and I'm with John Costa. just to shake it up, yeah. The difference that travel makes just makes you question everything and what you normally do. So it's good to have this one as a special, I think, because it gives us a chance to really reflect on that.
So we're going to compare notes about our two respective recent trips, and this isn't about travel bragging. This is kind of about trying to figure out what we benefited from, what the gain has been from our international travels, and then also how that might reflect back into our experience of living in a place like Leicester. To start off with you, John, where did you visit, and what was the purpose of your visit?
Well, I returned to Nigeria, actually. I've been to Nigeria about 19 years ago on a trip for a couple of weeks, which was fascinating. And then earlier this year, I got asked to be involved in a new television station, a new media house called S24. And I went in August for 2 weeks, which was a fascinating insight, really. I think 19 years ago, I went to Lagos mainly, which was crazy. What a place. And went to Abuja, which I guess was the size of Market Harbour back then. And in August, I went to Abuja for 2 weeks. And it was, now it's a fully blown capital city like anywhere else, associated brands, but just really busy. But this time I went back and I stayed for 3 weeks and had a couple of unexpected trips to a place called Katsina, which is in northern Nigeria, which is, according to somewhere like the Foreign Office, is somewhere where a British national shouldn't go. Donald Trump, the week before I went, started making noises about Nigeria and then threatened to invade while I was there or send missiles or whatever. So yeah, it was a really interesting place to be because it was about the media, but then it was more about the international spotlight on Nigeria as a place for violence, I guess, and criminality. So just kind of got immersed in that, and it was a fascinating trip, really. It wasn't a holiday, it wasn't that kind of travel, but certainly going somewhere else that pushes you outside your comfort zone and tests all of your boundaries and your preconceptions of places, and also test some of your prejudices as well about people prejudiced towards me and vice versa. So yeah, it was very insightful. And about yourself, where did you go?
My trip was to Japan,
I'd love to go and visit.
It's well worth it, and it's the furthest I've been anywhere, so it was like traveling east. So it was a fairly, it was a long haul flight, so you're looking at 12, 14 hours in economy on the back of a plane, eating fairly rubbish food. But it was just one of those experiences where there's so many things, because it's a modern country and it's got other resources of a modern country, it's technologically proficient, but it is, you don't really get away from the urban area because it's a big, Japan's got a particular dynamic for its urban areas. Its population is mainly in the coastal areas, the valleys, because the rest of the country is mountainous, so you can't really build there. You've got small villages and towns and things, but mainly it's the big urban areas. So we stayed in Nagoya and Osaka, and just using things like the Shinkansen, the bullet train, getting on the metro, just travelling around. We were there just over 2 weeks, so it was like a enough of an experience to kind of, when you walk in, I always describe it, when you walk into a new department store or kind of out-of-town shopping store, that kind of thing, you scope it, first of all, to see what's there. So the first visit was really just a kind of a scoping exercise. There's lots of day trips out. And then the next time, if we go another time, then it'll be a case of, kind of trying to figure out something specific that we wanted to focus on.
So one thing I wanted to ask you, Rob, about your trip to Japan was when we went to Cambodia together back in 2018, we visited Angkor Wat, the massive site there, religious site. And I remember thinking, everything that I'd seen about it, read about it, or watched on television, it was always very kind of peaceful and serene and all that. And it was absolute chaos with tourists taking selfies and all that. And in the end, we kind of went, okay, well, that's Angkor Wat. Let's go and find some of the outlying temples to look at, which were a little bit quieter, which once we'd made that decision, actually made the day a bit more interesting. But there was people taking selfies and, you know, tourists from all over the world. What was Japan like? Because my view is, they've been pushing back against the behaviour and of foreigners, but also certain areas are starting to, like, well, actually, no, you can't walk into my house and take a selfie and put in screens up. So what was your experience?
Well, the first thing is, you fit in with Japanese culture, they don't fit in with you.
And do you think that's one of the rare things that makes Japan different?
I think
from
it keeps
people?
It as a cohesive society, so they're not a multicultural society. So if you go as a foreigner, as somebody from abroad, then it's your job. In the urban areas, all the signs and all of the ticket machines have English. They have multi-language things, but they don't speak English. The Japanese people don't speak English. They don't try and accommodate speaking English. So you may be using a translator on your phone, Google Translate or something like that. So that's the first thing. You've got to make the effort to fit in with them.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that has a refreshing kind of boundary. So don't go and get frustrated. But so it's learning those rhythms. But then the second side of it is, yes, there is the kind of tourism element to this. And the friends that we were with when we went to Nagoya. So we went to Nagoya for a few days and we were with some friends. And then we moved on to Osaka and they went back to Thailand. And they were basically there to selfie farm because they had a small amount of time. And this is what happens with, you get the Chinese and the Indian tourists who come on package trips, basically. The Chinese particularly, it's workers' groups. They get driven in on a coach, they go to a specific place, they then want the selfie picture, so it's lots of performative selfies, as we saw in Angkor Wat, and then then it's on to the next place. And these trips do like an hour in one place and an hour in another place, so you're just kind of selfie farming. But that's because they've only got 4 or 5 days holiday and they want to get as much in as possible to say we've been out in the world. But I think what it lacks and what it kind of maybe what I would do different next time is to kind of say, no, let's hold back. And there's a whole other world that isn't that this just, you know, you're just wandering from gift shop to gift shop in a tourist place. Kyoto was, you know, I'd even say avoid Kyoto if you can. It was just over tourist. And it's people walking around in kimonos, and you've got Westerners walking around in kimonos thinking that they're in some kind of medieval Japanese fantasy.
So it becomes almost like cosplay.
Yeah, LARPing, live action role play, and they're doing that.
Yeah, fascinating, isn't it?
Did you get an opportunity to LARP when you were in Nigeria?
Well, yeah, because it's interesting. When I was on my August trip, I got given a two-piece suit in green, which I look very fetching, and a hat, a traditional sort of Nigerian hat, which is interesting because I said, you know, what do the colours define? You know, is it a sign of respect? Can people from the different tribal groups and all wear the same kind of hat? And they were like, yeah, because that's a symbol of being Nigerian, wearing the hat. And I took the hat with me this time. And I was due to come home on the Tuesday, and one of the camera people, Ben, Mr. Ben, his daughter was getting married, and he'd invited me a couple of weeks before I went down there. And I said, well, I couldn't because I'm flying back, unfortunately. But my trip got extended a week. So everyone was very happy, in particular Mr. Ben, that I was going to be able to go to this wedding. And the colours were purple, red, orange and green. And luckily my hat's got a lot of green in it. And I had this green shirt that I'm wearing today, funnily enough. And so I kind of turned up at this wedding. With my hat on, everyone was absolutely delighted that I'd taken the time. And of course, I'm very aware, I think, because of the conditioning in the UK of sort of, you know, cultural appropriation and things like that. You know, should you be wearing this hat? But I think it's more about why you're wearing it, rather than it's not pantomime or role play or that kind of stuff. You know, I was wearing it as a sign of respect because Mr. Ben wanted me to, or would appreciate me doing it. And everybody kind of went along with that. So yeah, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? We talk about cultural appropriation, and you know, if you went to Scotland as a tourist, should you put a hat on with ginger hair and a hat, and should you be wearing something that was tartan and stuff? And it's quite clearly people can tell people that are there travelling meaningfully and people that are just being touristic, I think. So Rob, What do you think your relationship is as someone from the UK, from England, with Japan, compared to your friends that you went with, your partner from Thailand, and some of the other tourists that you see, like the Chinese or maybe the Korean? Is their relationship with Japan driven by recent history, sort of, you know, pre-post-war treatment and stuff, which we see a lot about in the news? Or whereas you're coming at it from the point of view of the sort of the exotic and things that you learnt about Japan, the Orient type thing?
That's an interesting question. I wouldn't describe Japan as exotic. You know, in that sense, that's a kind of, you know, that and you know, the frame of reference of kind of 19th century Eastern, you know, mysticism, if you like. And the interesting thing is this is the urban areas are just, you know, if you want to know how to run a metro area, a city, the UK would be well advised to go and learn from people in Japan. It's spotless, it's well structured, it's organised. And it's lots of people using the resources efficiently and effectively. And there's a whole list of things like...
Not to the detriment of others or trying to get ahead.
Things like having plenty of toilets. You know, every railway station has loads of toilets. So it's about making things work. I describe it, while Japan is a high-tech country, it's actually slightly different from that. It's a well-engineered country. And you get promoted and you get social recognition on the basis of how effective you are at making things work. Whereas in the UK, it's about how you present yourself and your persona and how you spin things and what it looks like. So it's all about the optics, not about how things actually work. So, you know, I come back to the UK, go to St. Pancras Station, and there's two toilets in one of the biggest international interchanges, the only international interchange railway station in the UK, and it's got two blocks of toilets. And it's that, and there's always a massive queue for them, and they're overused. It's like, just put five more, six more sets of toilets there. They wouldn't think twice about that in Japan. And it's like there's something different in the mindset here, that people are a hindrance, whereas there it's about supporting people.
And is it the fact that our worldview is ourselves rather than the world? Because I always think of that American thing, wasn't it, about where they have the World Series in baseball, and it's like, well, only American team players, is it a World Series?
Because it was named after a newspaper called The World.
Was it?
That's where it was. That's where it comes from. But the one thing I would say is that I haven't seen the other side of Japan. I only got a hint of it, and you can feel it as you're travelling around. And it's like if you travel from Leicester to the Lake District, or when you're engaged with the non-urban areas and the countryside and the wilder areas, if you like, you suddenly get a sense that there's something deeper underneath this. And we went to a few places. We went to Nara, where the deer park is, and there's temples there. We were looking around them, and there's lots and lots of tourists there. So, people coached in, and we kind of went off in what was the wrong direction, but we ended up exploring some of the smaller temples, and you got this sense from the landscape. It wasn't that you understood what it was, but you recognise that there's another world here, a deeper, more mythological, you know, deeper rooted world, which is the urban surface is one thing. The mythological roots of the landscape and the countryside are something completely different.
And also it takes away... time is irrelevant, because then it's like, well, I didn't have the time to learn about everything to do with it. Well, yeah, because you just don't have the time. So it's about taking the time. And I guess this also comes into things, you know, what kind of preparation did you do?
Loads of YouTube videos, walking tour videos, a load of ChatGPT and about getting the itinerary right, because we had a very tight itinerary for the first couple of days, because people we were meeting up, they had a short amount of time, so everything was kind of very well executed. But I'm glad we did that, even though it was like a challenge with jet lag. I just fell asleep in the back of the car when we were driving between different places, but I got to see lots of things that I wouldn't have otherwise have gone to see immediately. So it kind of, you know, it just push it through it. And did you, in Nigeria, did you get away from the towns, the urban areas? Did you manage to get out into the countryside and that? Or was it just that you were always with people?
I was always with people, and particularly moving up to the north, obviously having to have protection, which is a really interesting situation to be in, because actually you feel like you're inviting the instability because you're there, because you're different. So would these people be left alone, or would they just be unlucky enough to have an incident happen with banditry, or am I inviting it by being here? And by talking to people on and off camera, you realise that they were just happy that you were there because you were presenting the reality of their world in a way that was being misrepresented at that particular time by American media and the comments by the US president. So from that point of view, I think that you get the support of the people there because you're there, rather than anyone angry that you're there, that you might attract some negativity. I think the thing you also realise when you go to somewhere like northern Nigeria, where your government says you shouldn't be and all these sorts of things, is that, you know, they were like, oh, we've got police protection. Okay. Well, straight away, that really doesn't mean anything to me, because these guys are on, like, you know, £40 a month, and there's seven of them, you know, and they're ever so grateful and delighted to be doing something different and, you know, working with you. And so I show them a lot of respect and ask about them and their families and stuff. And, well, these guys are being paid to get between a bandit and me, you know. And I'm very aware of that. I don't treat that lightly, you know, because these guys are people. But also what it makes you realise is that when these guys are sort of hanging off their Toyota truck, like they do, almost like sort of like Mexican sort of Sicario vibe with the police there armed to the teeth. And then there's a little minivan behind, which is sort of, you know, slightly dilapidated and probably could do with a bit of a paint job, where you know the local journalists are. And then there's a big shiny white van behind it, and that's where I'm sitting with the S24 colleagues, the news team. Is, well, if I was someone who was a bandit, I'd think, well, I won't shoot the police thing. I won't shoot that because that's got local people. I'll shoot that because there's probably some dude in there who's come in his big white shiny van. And it was really interesting because everywhere I went over that week felt very safe, very secure. And the only time I felt unsafe was not because it was unsafe, but because I got someone said to me, "Mr. John, stay in the van." Those six words, we were all laughing later on in the day when we're having some food. And I just said, because what happens then, there was two policemen standing outside and the van door, and of course you can't open the windows and all that because they're like, "Stay in the van." And I'm like, well, everyone come, if they were to attack now, they'd know that he's probably in the van, whereas actually it was actually safer to be outside. And so it's really weird, and I'm trying to explain this to people, that sometimes the protection they try to give you to make you feel safe makes everything unsafe. Whereas if you were just there, I mean, we stood on markets, we went into markets, I stood on road junctions and all that sort of stuff, which, sending pictures home, everyone's like, "What are you doing? What are you, crazy? Why are you there?" I remember one of my old army mates said, "Why haven't you got an helmet and like body armour?" Because I said, "Well, because I don't need a helmet and body armour. You've just got to go and experience people." So we've got two versions of travel that you and I are talking about here, where immersion in culture and immersion in people's lives and an opportunity to talk to people is a real privilege about, you know, what they do and stuff. And we were making content about this new road, which could have been really quite one-dimensional and stuff, because it's a new road and, you know, it's fantastic that they're spending this money. And I said, well, let's go and interview some taxi drivers who are going to spend less money maintaining their three-wheeler trike, like tuk-tuks type thing, because the roads are better. And that was much more interesting content, because actually it wasn't about the state government's building this road, spending this money, your life will be better. It's like, my life is better because this money was spent, because I can get from A to B, but also my job is taking people from A to B, but also B and C and these connecting roads, and I'm paying less for my maintenance, so keeping more money to educate my kids. So they were like, that's a really different way. And I said, well, you're looking for an answer to some of the challenges around media in Nigeria. It's not copying what we do here. It's about, what do you do? What do you do well, but how could you do it better? And so for me, it's like Citizen's Eye 2.0, really.
Yeah, we didn't really go to Japan we didn't engage with anybody that we didn't know anybody there. We, you know, we kept ourselves to ourselves, as you do, and you travel around finding things out, and that kind of introductions, it'd be great to go back. It's like we did in Cambodia, like we've done in Thailand, where you go back and you do some teaching and you're actually engaging with people.
Well, our second trip to Cambodia was very different, wasn't it? Because it suddenly felt we knew people.
Yeah.
We then slotted into the rhythm, and the people that we were talking to, it wasn't our first trip.
You've got to function, you're doing something. So it's like, if you just go there as a tourist, you're just wandering around. I mean, there's some great places. I fell in love with stationery shops, and I loved the absolutely think this is a fantastic idea. When the light is on red at the pedestrian crossing, you don't walk, you don't jaywalk. You wait for it to turn green, and the first time you do it, from a UK perspective, it's like you're feeling this is not right. There's no traffic. 2 o'clock in the morning, there's no traffic, and people will just wait for the light to change. But it calms everything down. It changes the nature of the way that you do everything. It has a knock-on effect about things like, you know, kind of your blood pressure, you know, your sense of indignation about things. And it's like, it's just has a calming effect. And then because everybody's socialized to that, it's the norm and it's what's expected, and it just falls into the background then. So you see people crossing at the junctions, and the traffic comes from the corner around the right, I think it is, and behind people. So you've got the right to cross while the lights are green, and the traffic comes and stops and waits at the crossing. And people were not oblivious to those cars, oblivious to any sense that there's traffic waiting for them to move on. Whereas here, people would be revving their engines and pushing in, and you'd feel that it was a rush.
So, Rob, when I was there in August in Nigeria, I don't know if I told you this story. This kind of chap got into a lift that I was in, and he was there, two big bags, and clearly he had made his own suit. You know, you could tell that it was handmade. And I just engaged him in conversation, and he looked exhausted. And I just remember he kind of, you know, perked up, gave me a business card, and if you ever want a suit, like, give me a shout and stuff. And we got chatting away, and what's your football team, all the usual stuff that Nigerians ask you. And then he went, and he was just exhausted, and I just thought, it was irrelevant whether I wanted a suit. It's like I just gave him time and respected his hustle, that was his thing. And I think we look at, through the sort of European media, global North lens of Africans, and you know how many there are, what they're doing, that kind of hustle, that sort of reputation that maybe Nigerians have for, you know, scammers and all this kind of stuff. Because I talked to my colleagues about it there, about, you know, what reputations are and how they can be easily won but very difficult to get rid of if they're not true. And what I'm thinking of is your trip to Japan. A lot of what we hear about Japan is sort of, you know, really kind of work ethic, working really hard, people working themselves to death, you know, people in suits sleeping on subways and in doorways and stuff because they're exhausted, high suicide rate and all this sort of stuff. We never really talk about some of the positive aspects that you're talking about society and order and maybe the, you know, people's well-being that comes with that. So we've got this kind of, there's always these extremes that we share negatively or positively about certain places, and it's only when you go and find and immerse yourself can you have a comment about it.
You know, the wise advice from a colleague of ours, Eric, is you know, you can look at the surface and you think that we're the same, and it's very different. And we experienced, in my first international trip was 2012, going to Thailand. And that was before the rise of smartphones and the introduction. So people would be, you know, you'd have the taxi drivers, the tuk-tuk drivers, the moto drivers sitting outside waiting for customers, and they'd be reading books and magazines. And then a few years later, they're all on smartphones. And you think, you look at it from the surface point of view, and you're not exploring the symbolic and mythological and structural intercultural differences that exist within there. You view it very much on somebody's wearing a Nike shirt, you know, they've got a Liverpool FC or a Manchester United shirt on. It doesn't mean to say that they share the same cultural reference points. And I think that's the danger. And I think the idea, what's interesting is, it's when you get away, and you've probably experienced this on your Nigeria trip, when you get away and you haven't got your Google Translate and you haven't got things in English, and if you're on your own in a place and you can't speak the language, that's travel. Because you are then exposed to something which is completely out of your comfort zone, out of your bubble of experience, which you're familiar with. And it's like we ship people around the world to go to places where they are almost entirely familiar. So, you know, the cliche of the Spanish holiday maker going to the package holiday hotel and only staying in the hotel because
John Ball pub.
Yeah, you know, it's where the spoon's in the sun, and, you know, the carry-on films in the 70s kind of explored this. But actual, what is real travel is actually being away from that, because that then is the confrontation with difference, and difference does exist in the world. To deny difference And I think that's a more interesting divide than the north and the south and the developed and the undeveloped, or whatever phraseology that is put on there. I think a kind of there's a symbolic familiarity, and then there's the unfamiliar. And I think that's really important, that we maintain those things which are unfamiliar. We don't have to explain everything about our culture to other people, and they don't have to explain everything to us as travellers. It's okay to have those differences, and we have to figure out a way of coexisting, but we don't have to be the same. We don't have to adopt the same universal culture.
And do you think because people don't always have the opportunity to do that kind of travel, that it actually allows things like the media or, you know, politicians, whatever, to reinforce certain narratives about particular people? Oh, they're this, they're like that. And you've got nothing, particularly from, say, your school education, or if you've not had an opportunity to travel, you've got nothing to counter that with?
It comes back to, and I think, you know, Citizen's Eye International, that we've talked about many times, but when we were in Cambodia and we were talking to the students about telling their own stories, that's what it boils down to. And the work you're doing in Nigeria is about just helping people to have a bit more confidence that their stories are legitimate, and they don't have to be examined from a Western analytical framework, but they can be examined internally and coherently for themselves, and then we can cross compare and look at advantages and disadvantages or whatever. We can think about them strategically. We don't have to make everything the same.
So Rob, for this last section, I want you to think, ask you about, do you think that your experience of travelling and the way that you travel, when I look at the way that you prepare, the things that you do when you're away, you know, us coming back and having these kind of conversations, do you think somewhere like a city like Leicester that has lots of people from different places in the world, it makes you look at it slightly differently about, you know, how you would organise something if you were going to do an event? How do you approach inviting people?
Well, some sense of organisation would be welcome. There is no organisation for intercultural understanding in a place like Leicester. It's been abandoned. It's just people are fend for themselves, form their small groups, form your little echo chambers, stick with the people who are familiar. You go to your Polish shop, your East European shop, you go to your Thai supermarket, you do these things and you stick in your little groups. And it's like that's a lack of investment in a common culture. Particularly for something like Leicester, and also a devaluation of, to use the phrase, indigenous culture, of the inherited culture of people who, you know, the population that you're coming and visiting. So there's a kind of almost a kind of sense that, I mean, the question I wanted to ask you was about, and it's related to what you're saying, is like the airport culture. So airports, you know, they're kind of this space which the traveller's experience is homogenised, and you're pretty much getting, by and large, the same kind of experience wherever you go. There's variations and, you know, things
it's like,
that work.
It's like eating in a world food court.
Yes, you get annoyed by having a squeaky wheel on your trolley or something like that, you know, and it's like, but really, you know, you're doing this amazing thing of being travelling around the world within 24 hours, which was impossible, you know, 50, 60 years ago. It was just a dream. You'd have to go on a boat. And so now that expectation, what was the airport like at
Abuja?
Abuja, what was that?
Fantastic.
Like? Yeah, modern.
Yeah, modern, great coffee, bookshops, lots of toilets, lots of people being very respectful, checking that you're okay. No unnecessary rush. The international airport, the local domestic flights were quite interesting because it's very much like, hurry up and wait, and then, you know, is it going to go on time? You know, you're up in the air for less than an hour. I did four internal flights, I think, you know. But that's like doing an internal flight anywhere else. You know, it's like going on an EasyJet or Ryanair. You're almost in that. You're not flying mode. You know, you could be getting on a train. You could be getting on a ferry kind of thing. So, I mean, I found it very kind of respectful. People were interested in you. I mean, obviously, I looked different as well. So that means that, you know, they approach you. And because I talk to everybody, you know, Miss Alima, the CEO of S24, she said, John, you know, Mr. John, everyone talks highly of you because you take time to talk to everybody. And so, like, you know, I'll get out the vehicle when we get to, like, the S24 media house. The first thing I'll do is I'll walk round the back and I'll wave at all the guys at the security on the gate. And I remember the first time I did it, they were all shocked because they were like, they all came running over thinking I was waving them to come over. And then we kind of got into this routine, and I just remember there was this one day, and everyone knew it was my last day. And I got out of the vehicle, and as I got up, they'd all lined up by the gate and were just like waving at me, because it was like people just don't acknowledge them normally. And for me, I think that's really important. I used to talk to security guards, I used to talk to people, you know, I'd engage people in the toilets in conversation. And of course, when you then go to an event, then everyone's looking for who you should talk to at this big digital Nigeria exhibition. And people just came up to me. And I'll tell you a funny story, Rob. I was there. It was a packed conference hall. The first day of this digital Nigeria conference, the vice president was coming to talk. And there was one empty chair next to me. Yeah, I think there was a couple of women, so they didn't come to sit next to me. Like, so there was one empty chair. And this lady came over and said, "Is this chair empty?" And I said, "Yes." And this guy came over about 5 minutes, sat down, young lad. First thing I noticed, he had no socks on his shoes. And he had this really great burgundy-type blazer. And I was like, "Mate, like your blazer, fantastic." "Oh, thank you very much." So then someone stopped talking, so we got in chatting, and I gave him a card. And I said, "Well, I'm here when the live streaming's not on. I'm going to be doing some interviews if you want to be interviewed." So we followed each other on WhatsApp. And I'd not seen him for about an hour and a half, and then I interviewed him and all that sort of stuff. 2 days later, he got in touch, and he said, "You'll never guess." He said, "I was talking to a friend of mine, a woman, and I mentioned your name." And she said, "Oh, I know John." And they'd done one of our period poverty things that we'd done through the Parallel Lives Network 2 years before.
Wow.
Online with some of the Nigerian Global Health Master students. And how weird is that? I mean, literally 220 million people. I meet this guy because it's an empty chair, and one of his friends has done one of the 30 people that did our online period poverty training. And I just think that just shows you that the world is a village, but you have to approach that as well from that has to be your view. If you look for issues and problems and divisions and reasons to hate people, you will easily find them. If you look for a reason to connect with people, have meaningful conversations, and then stay in touch for the right reasons, and I think you'll find many of those as well, but they're all the things that are hidden, like you said.
And vice versa, if you look for ways to annoy and misbehave with people, you will easily get you will, to use a phrase, trigger them. So in Japan, it was very much a case of, you don't speak loudly in the street, you don't speak on the buses and trains, because you'll just annoy people. But that's your problem, not theirs.
Absolutely,
yeah. So
nice one.
That's fantastic, and I think it's rekindled my kind of sense that we should do more international travelling.
Well,
but proper travel, not just tourist travelling, but you know, actually go for a purpose like you've had in Nigeria.
Yeah. And so, also, I think events in Leicester, when it comes to talking to people from here and from people from other places about their travel and what that travel means to them, with meaningful stories. So it's not, you know, I'm not interested in your photos from going to Disney. I'm interested in your photos from traveling by bus up in the mountains with local people where no one spoke, and who was kind to you and who put you up and stuff like that. And what did you eat? You know, I just ate Nigerian food when I was there. So yeah,
I think that's the meaningful stories is the point of spotlight on whatever we're talking about each week here. Brilliant. On Source AM.
Brilliant. Thank you, mate.